CBS debate. I'm Isaiah Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. U.S. President Donald Trump became the first sitting American president to step into North Korea on Monday. Trump has agreed to resume talks with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, but at the same time, not lifting sanctions. Is this a continuation of more talks but no action on the part of Washington, or the beginning of something new? Stay with us as we take a look at what all this could mean on this debate.
U.S. President Donald Trump met North Korean leader Kim Jong-un at the heavily fortified border between North Korea and South Korea Sunday. While Washington and Pyongyang have been locked in a stalemate over North Korea's nuclear program and U.S.-led sanctions, Kim expressed optimism regarding the U.S. president.
The gesture of President Trump crossing the military demarcation line is an expression of his willingness to eliminate the unfortunate past and open a new future.
President Trump called it an honor to be the first U.S. leader to set foot in North Korea and touted his strong relationship with Kim. However, when asked about whether he would ease sanctions, President Trump indicated his hard line on the issue had not changed.
They're staying on. I mean, at some point, look, I'm looking forward to taking them off. I don't like sanctions being on his country. I'm looking forward, but the sanctions remain, yes.
President Trump received a frosty welcome for his visit to Seoul with several demonstrations voicing support for relief in sanctions on North Korea.
Have any of the U.S. officials kept the promises? They shook hands in Singapore and they betrayed in Hanoi. That's the real character of U.S. leadership. How can they believe Trump and the U.S.?
President Trump and the North Kim have agreed to enable lower-level officials start fresh negotiations. The meeting between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un at the DMZ generated a historic videographic document. Now left to so-called working groups, is finding compromise in solving the issues surrounding the North's denuclearization and the necessary sanctions relief from the U.S. Frank Smith, Press TV. Seoul.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program out of Pittsburgh University lecturer and author Daniel Kovalik, and out of Somerset former U.S. intelligence officer Bob Ayers. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start this off in Somerset with Bob. How significant is what has taken place? Trump stepping into North Korea, in your perspective?
Depends on how you measure significance. I'm sure in President Trump's mind it's extremely significant, but the way I would suggest we measure significance is in the results. What happens as a result of this third summit meeting between the two rulers? If history is anything to predict from, I'd suggest that what we're going to see is more talking and nothing will happen. The North Koreans have become extremely adept over the last 50 or so years of making agreements, taking whatever they were offered to sign that agreement, and then breaking it as soon as it became convenient. So I'm not sure that the fact that Donald Trump stepped over an imaginary line of the demilitarized zone is going to change North Korean behavior at all.
Daniel, your take on all of this, does this send a message at all to the North Koreans or not?
Well, it certainly does. I mean, the fact that a U.S. president visited North Korea is an incredibly important symbolic gesture. But yes, of course, the proof is in the pudding. We'll have to see, what results from this. I do think as a precondition for negotiations, I would like to see sanctions lifted on North Korea, as I would like to see them lifted from Iran as well, in order for negotiations to proceed in an equal footing. But look, I support negotiations and I support peace talks, and this has to be at least seen as a very positive sign.
Okay. Well, Bob, the act seems to have been somewhat spontaneous in that even Kim Jong-un said he never expected to meet Trump there. And do you think that this type of spontaneity has caught even some of Trump's own advisors and cabinet members off guard, such as perhaps Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and National Security Advisor John Bolton?
Well, of course it has. We have a 180-degree shift in international diplomacy as currently being practiced by the Trump administration. Typically what you have are you have people in the State Department, I'll say low to mid-level people in the State Department, working with low to mid-level people in another country to try to hammer out at least some of the broad understandings that they're trying to negotiate. And then after some of the details have been hammered out, ultimately the two leaders are brought together and they, with a great fanfare and lots of photographs, will sign a piece of paper agreeing to all of the work that had been done by the staffs previously. What we have now are the seniors getting together and saying, let's have a deal, and then turning around and walking away and hoping that the staff can put something together that is agreeable to both parties. Mm. And that's where we have a problem, because what we have in this negotiation with North Korea is a complete absence of what we understand the objective of the negotiation to be. We've talked about denuclearization. The U.S. wants denuclearization. Well, that's characterized as what? Having no nuclear weapons in North Korea and being able to verify or validate that they don't. And we expect the North Koreans to agree to abandon their nuclear program, to agree to allow international inspectors to go through every cave under every underground facility in North Korea looking for residuals of nuclear weapons. And then we're going to give North Korea what in order to make them do this? North Korea has achieved everything they've got now because they're a nuclear power. And now we're saying abandon that and go back to being another nice, small Asian state that's not threatening or troubling anybody and is no longer on the world stage. I don't see that ever happening in North Korea.
Hmm. And your take, Daniel, on this, why do you think we see this type of spontaneity by Trump? Is it just the way he is to, as he says, make the deal? Are there some, actually, analysts say that, as a matter of fact, he's actually trying to go around the neocons that sit nearby him. Your thoughts on that?
My guess is it's a little bit of both. I think Trump is a man of spontaneity and impulse, and this probably reflects that. But I also think he has surrounded himself with neocons like John Bolton and Mike Pompeo, who don't want peace with anyone. And he may see that he has to go around those people to make peace.
Well, let me just open that up a little bit for our viewers. What do you mean, like, that when you say that they don't want peace with anyone? Why is that the case?
Well, Trump himself said that Bolton wants war with everybody. I mean,
yes.
Why? Why is that? I mean, there might be a lot of reasons. You know, the U.S. has become a nation on a permanent war footing. Jimmy Carter recently said that the U.S. is the most warlike nation that's ever existed, and objectively, that's true. We have a war economy, and we seem, one, economically addicted to war, but also psychologically so. And it is a sickness. You know, and the irony is we talk about, Korea, North Korea should get rid of its, what, 3 or 4 nuclear weapons? Meanwhile, we're sitting on thousands of them here in the United States. I'd like to see the U.S. start to denuclearize. I'd like to see the U.N. search in every cave in the U.S. or whatnot to root out our nuclear weapons. By the way, we're the only country, we have to remember, that's ever used them against another country. The U.S. needs a shift in its mentality away from war. Mm. And towards negotiations. And if this move with Kim is some direction, move in that direction, then I welcome it.
Okay, well, Bob, what about that? It definitely seems to be double standards when it comes to the United States and making these decisions with countries, for example, like North Korea, that actually has nuclear weapons. So as you rightly brought up, what would it take, you think, for the North Koreans to really come to the table sincerely to try to negotiate with the United States? Now, an entity, one that's been the only one that's used nuclear weapons, two, we've seen in dealing with Iran, not keeping with its agreements. What do you think that Trump or the American administration right now can do to offer them that really, as Trump would say, would end up in a deal?
I doubt if there's really anything that the United States can offer North Korea that represents sufficient incentive for them to abandon their nuclear program. You must consider that North Korea has a strong element of paranoia in their national psyche. They, in many cases, view the world through the same prism as the old Soviet Union did. You know, they're surrounded by enemies. The United States is occupying one of their borders. The South Koreans are an enemy. The Japanese are for sure an enemy. The North Koreans remember the Japanese occupying the country for 50 years. So you have this paranoid regime. You have a regime that has, for the most part, on their own, attained a nuclear club membership, which is very, very prestigious to them. And they have mined other world powers like the United States, China, Russia, France, the United Kingdom, India, Pakistan,
and Israel.
Israel, yes. Well, at least Israel is not officially a nuclear power. Mm-hmm. Unofficially, of course they are, but officially they're not. So the question is, what sort of incentive could you offer North Korea? You're going to give them an unlimited amount of funds? Or are you going to go in and completely rebuild their manufacturing infrastructure, go in and rebuild their agricultural infrastructure? What is it you could offer them? All of these massive changes that would have to take place in North Korea would not be able to be achieved by the North Koreans themselves. In other words, if you gave them a checkbook with unlimited funds in the bank, I'm not confident that they have the wherewithal and the ability to actually manage a modernization program in their own country.
Mm. Well, Daniel, your take on that, because you've heard Bob say basically a paranoid regime, but when we look at the reality, we look at the United States right there, and of course the other countries that he named allies of the United States, and basically doing the becking of the United States, whether we're talking about South Korea, we're talking about Japan. And is North Korea a paranoid country, or is it a cautious country that has gone to nuclear weapons because of self-survival?
Well, we have a saying in the U.S. that even paranoids have real enemies, right? And clearly North Korea has real enemies. And you know, we have to remember the history of this. The U.S. leveled North Korea to the ground during the Korean War. Okay, there wasn't a building left standing over one story high. The U.S. also, for good measure, on the way out of town, destroyed, you know, what, 27 dams that were needed for irrigation. And frankly, the North Korea did a pretty good job modernizing its country, given that it had to build everything from the root after that. So first of all, I don't agree with the assertion that North Korea can't, use money wisely to modernize. It's shown that it can under very difficult circumstances. And I think North Korea looks realistically at things like Libya, where Gaddafi agreed to give up any nuclear aspirations to be let into the Western world again, and only to be toppled shortly later by the West, who showed no appreciation for that. So, you know, I think North Korea has every reason to be cautious and every reason to hold on to its nuclear weapons until the U.S. shows it's willing to let countries like North Korea survive.
Well, let's look at that, Bob. Why not lift sanctions against North Korea? We have seen, obviously, the North Korean leader now. This is the third meeting, though a short one today, meeting with U.S. President Donald Trump, obviously interested in compromising in some form anyway. Why not lift the sanctions? Why not allow the North Koreans to exist like the majority of countries in the world? Why continue to use these sanctions against Pyongyang? Do you consider this tactic legal?
Well, let's look at this. You say, why not allow North Korea to exist? North Korea as an independent sovereign state has existed since the early 1950s. That means they've been an independent sovereign state for going on almost 70 years.
Existing meaning freely allowed to trade. Freely allowed to trade. That's what I'm talking about.
Well, they've been freely allowed to trade with some of their other partners, not with every other country in the world, not through force by the United States, but through design from North Korea. You know, the North Koreans themselves were, quote, while they had the right to exist freely, they were engaged in espionage and sabotage operations against South Korea. They were sending agents and agent escorts into South Korea up into the 80s. They were kidnapping people from Japan and bringing them back to North Korea to serve in the North Korean entertainment industry. This is not just simply a state that is being subjected to external pressure. This is a rogue state. And the pressure that's being exerted on them is as a result of their own actions. Now, we can feel sorry for North Korea. As the other guests mentioned, North Korea had been pretty much destroyed by the war. What he didn't mention is that the war was started by North Korea. And the destruction that was visited upon that country was as a result of their own actions, not as a result of the United States being an aggressor. It was as a result of North Korea being the aggressor. Now, the sanctions are one way of trying to bring pressure on a rogue state to make them behave in a more desirable manner.
Okay. Well, interesting use of words. Daniel, your take. When I hear Bob talk, of course, I am sitting in Tehran, and of course, another country that has been sanctioned by the United States. When I hear that, it is if some type of adult or superior entity is talking about these lower beings of existence.
Yeah.
Isn't that the bottom line, that is the problem? It's the U.S.'s arrogance in dealing with other countries?
Of course. Let me say a few things about that. Again, going back to this question about whether North Korea can modernize. As an American, I'd like to see the U.S. modernize. I'd like to see the U.S. build a few speed trains, fix a few roads. You know, the U.S. is the only country that is de-developing, and we have to look at that. But also, let's talk about rogue states. Let's talk about the millions of people the U.S. killed in Southeast Asia, in Japan, in Korea. You know, I'm sorry, whatever North Korea has done pales in comparison to what the U.S. has done in Asia alone.
Vietnam, let us not forget, while you're at it.
Well, I meant that, Southeast Asia, but Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Korea, Japan. I mean, Laos, let's not forget, was the most bombed country in world history by the United States, so we can't forget that. You know, again, the U.S. needs to have some self-awareness about how the rest of the world sees it. There's been two recent polls which show that by large numbers, people around the world see the U.S. as the greatest threat to peace in the world. And it is, objectively speaking. And the idea that the U.S. holds any moral superiority over any of these countries is frankly a sick joke. And the U.S. has to look inward and start spending some money on its own issues of poverty and infrastructure collapse, and stop worrying about scolding the rest of the world for their shortcomings.
Well, Bob, which entities profit the most from North Korea and South Korea being continually divided?
Which entities prosper the most? I'm not sure that there are any entities that prosper from the two countries, or from the one country being partitioned. I mean, certainly the United States defense industry doesn't profit from it. The U.S. military presence there is very small. It's smaller now than it's been historically in decades. The South Korean defense industry is pretty much absent. They rely on the United States. The North Korean defense industry is a product of their own sense called of chuche, which means self-reliance. They build their own tanks. They build almost all of their military equipment themselves. So their defense industry benefits from the confrontational status of the two countries. But having a defense industry in North Korea subtracts from resources available to do other things like education, hospitals, schools, roads, railroads, boats, things like that. So as it stands right now, I'm not sure that anyone benefits from the confrontational posture of those two countries.
Well, what about that, Daniel? What do you think? Do you think that, because in any situation, any conflict, any problem, we look at, basically, it always says you follow the money. You follow who would benefit, who would profit from a situation. Your take on that same question in dealing with North and South Korea, why does it seem that there are certain entities that really do not want to see those two countries that are divided right now to become one?
Well, again, I think the U.S. has largely a war economy. We spend about $1 trillion a year on the military, at least. And there are, you know, major U.S. corporations that benefit from that are able to charge, you know, money for airplanes that don't even fly, for example, or thousands of dollars for a toilet seat. It's a very corrupt system, and in those companies don't want to see peace anywhere, frankly. War is good for those companies. And to say that the U.S. is ratcheted down in Korea, Seoul, South Korea has a major U.S. military encampment with thousands of U.S. troops and a giant military base, which is very palpable in Seoul. The U.S. has never demilitarized from there, has never demilitarized from Japan, despite the fact that many Japanese, particularly in places like Okinawa, would like to see us out. So I think there are vested interests that don't want to see peace on the Korean Peninsula or anywhere, and I think we need to resist those forces.
And on that note, I'd like to thank both of our guests for being with us out of Pittsburgh, Daniel Kovalik, a university lecturer, and author Bob Ayers, former U.S. intelligence officer out of Somerset. And as always, viewers, we appreciate you being with us on Another Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing out for all the crew right here in Tehran. Thanks so much for being with us. Goodbye.